Good evening, everyone. Thank you very much for coming. I'm Bridget Husser, Director of the Centre for Analysis of Risk and Regulation, and I'd like to welcome you here this evening on behalf of my colleagues in CAR and also the ESRC, who have sponsored this event as part of their Social Science Week. The purpose of Social Science Week is to provide an insight into social science perspectives and how social science research influences our social, economic, and political lives. And the issue that we're going to be discussing this evening is, of course, a highly topical one, pandemic risk and risk management in the 21st century. It's a topic which touches on politics, business, health, and the relationship between science and society. Last May, Tony Blair called for a far more rational, balanced, and intelligent debate as to how risk is debated. Within months of that, the media was reporting, often with some alarm, human deaths from the H5N1 virus in China, Turkey, Vietnam, Indonesia. And then it continued to tell us about birds which had been infected with the virus and tracked their demise across Europe. We heard stories about how Germans were being warned about the dangers of cats contracting the virus and were being told to keep their cats indoors. We learned of contingency planning across the City of London. Members of staff announced to employers that they wouldn't be coming to work if bird flu was found in Britain. And head teachers reassured us parents that pupils had been told what to do if they found a dead bird on school premises. Is this a society acting rationally? Is it sensible precaution? Or is it unwarranted panic? What can we learn about risk management in the 21st century, a century when more than any other we are said to benefit from the advances in science? CAR's a multidisciplinary centre. It has an important interface with practice. So it's therefore fitting that this evening's topic is going to be debated by a distinguished panel drawn from different disciplinary backgrounds and also from practice. We have Professor Peter Baldwin, who's Professor of History at the University of California, Los Angeles. He's authored a number of books on the topic, Contagion and the State in Europe, and Disease and Democracy, a work on AIDS. Professor Thomas Abraham has come all the way across from Hong Kong, where he's director of the Public Health Media Project at Hong Kong University. And he's authored a book called The 21st Century Plague, The Story of SARS. Professor John Oxford, known to many of you, particularly being on television last night, I understand, John. He's professor of virology at St. Bartholomew's and the Royal London Hospital. He's scientific director of Retroscreen Virology, and he's also a writer on the subject of influenza. And David Frediani is executive director of MMC International, which is a parent company of Marsh, a leading risk and reinsurance company, which is very interested in risk and has helped to put together a global risks document and report for the World Economic Forum. Now, what we're going to do this evening is we're going to have a structured discussion with the panel, and then we're going to open it up towards the end to all of you to ask the panel questions and debate some of the things that you've heard this evening. But it was suggested in the pre-meeting it might be an interesting gauge to find out how many of you at this point in time are actually worried about the risk of a pandemic in the UK in the coming 12 months. So could those of you who are concerned raise your hands, and then we'll see how you pan out at the end. Who's good at counting? I'm not. Right, that's
5, 6, 7, 8.
That's about 10 to 15, isn't it? So we'll see if the panel persuades you one way or the other this evening. In a lecture in the London School of Economics last month, one of the world's leading social theorists, Ehrlich Beck, drew a distinction between risk and catastrophe. Risk, he said, means the anticipation of catastrophe, and the important word there is anticipation. At the moment at which risks become real, they cease to be risks, he said, and they become catastrophes. Risks are always events that are threatening. And he continued to claim that, unlike the past, we live in a world where we are increasingly occupied with debating, preventing, and managing risks, a world where we know much more about risks through science. But he said this greater appreciation of risk serves to heighten feelings of insecurity, hence his notion about risk being the anticipation of catastrophe. And he also claimed that it is rarely matched by a greater ability to control or manage risks. Now, those sorts of arguments are fairly well known to academic social scientists, and they raise a very interesting points of reference for this debate, I think. And I wanted to start off, Peter, by asking you if you think that modern societies, with their wealth of scientific expertise, view the threat of pandemics differently now than they were viewed in the past.
How close do I have to get to this to...
It'll tell you if you can't hear. Hands up if you can't hear.
Can you hear me? Is this working? Well, the issue of risk in modern society, of course, is a much broader one than just the pandemic. I didn't hear Mr. Beck's lecture the other day, but I do know one thing about him, and that is that he's a German, which means that he may attack the problem of risk differently than others do. And I brought, as a demonstration of this point, a Sunday supplement from the Berlin Tagesspiegel, which is my current home paper for the moment. The Tagesspiegel is sort of like the Guardian is in this country. It's, how should we say it, the concerned intellectual's paper. Now, this Sunday supplement, the kind of thing that you sort of take out as you're drinking your macchiato and eating your croissant, is called Dangerous World. And it has a series of articles on storms, earthquakes, floods, and pandemics. And it asks the question, is nature hitting back? Now, leave aside for the moment the issue of whether or not nature can be sort of anthropomorphized in this way, and has finally had enough of us humans, who by definition are thereby not really part of nature. It seems to me that one could just as well argue the opposite, that to the extent that nature is a want to take revenge on humanity, it is doing it less than it ever has before. Certainly, it seems to me indisputable that it is a better time to be an infant now almost anywhere on Earth than it ever has been before in human history. Does this mean that we worry about risk excessively? Does it mean that some cultures are more preoccupied with risk than others? Are we worrying about risk too much? It seems to me that we need to distinguish between predictable and unpredictable risks. Predictable ones like old age and sickness, unpredictable ones like mutating viruses and asteroids. Our society handles predictable risks, it seems to me, brilliantly. We have insurance, we have social insurance, we have an ever-increasing realm of insurance. We now insure for things that we never thought we could insure for before. Last week, the UN bought an insurance policy on Ethiopia's rainfall and the possibility of famine striking there, spending some $900,000 for an insurance policy that could have been used, the money, instead on feeding Ethiopians directly, but the assumption has been that the market solution may, in this case, in fact, spread the risk. In terms of pandemics, it seems to me that we handle these situations better than we ever have before, that we have a clearer idea of what it is that's going to hit us, and that in particular, in this case, the one that we're faced with, that we are not going to fall prey to the sorts of political problems that we did in the last major epidemic that we, at least in the Western nations, faced collectively, namely that of the AIDS epidemic. Because the coming epidemic, if it is going to be one, is going to be a democratic epidemic. It's one that's going to hit us all more or less in the same way and with the same ferocity. There won't be minorities who are singled out. There won't be the possibility of scapegoating in precisely the same way that it was with the AIDS epidemic. So that we will deal with it, possibly in a strict way, but in a much more just way, in a way that will allow the government to impose with a harsh hand if that becomes necessary, without aggravating all our allergic democratic responses to singling out certain groups and not others.
Thank you. John, as a scientist, do you think we're better able to cope with pandemics now than our predecessors?
Wow, you've put me on the spot there. Can I say, first of all, I found myself slightly in deep water here. I mean, I've not like a faintest idea what risk assessment's all about. I really haven't. I view this as public health. and maybe I'm the one person, or maybe there's two of us here, taking a different attitude here. To give you an example of that, we invited Dr. Sentamu, who's now the Archbishop of York, to open a pandemic window at the medical school. This is to commemorate 50 million people who died, not in the First World War, but who died in the influenza in 1918. This is the first memorial in the world to that. We have to push back. We cannot understand this from a public health point of view, or indeed any other point of view, unless we push back in history. And now, with due respect to our American colleagues here, Henry Ford, who was always coming out with this phrase that history is bunk, well, it's not bunk, certainly not from the public health point of view, and no one will understand this situation, this potential situation with influenza, until one does push back. And I can get you back to 1889. You more or less have to go back there to really understand what's happening here. Now, I've got one other thing to say about Dr. Sentamu. He came out recently, and we have to be totally careful about phrases here, about these politicians. We have to be very careful. We're not degenerating to a group of, like, Animal Farm here, that we're kind of developing into a society, you know, like 1984, like Animal Farm. We have to be jolly careful. We've had all this rendition and all this other stuff. So we have to be careful. We do not want to get into a situation like the tsunami in Southeast Asia, where they had the warning, they had the science behind them, they had a meteorologist who told one of those countries there was a problem, they gave him the sack. Now they're all arguing. You know, my own daughter was there on that island, and that night, Boxing Day, over a year ago, 6 billion tons of water pressure came towards her at 700 miles an hour for 8 hours until it hit that beach, where she would have been unless she'd overslept that morning. So, you know, there's science there, and they want to get a blind bit of notice about it. They could have prepared themselves, and they didn't. They weren't prepared to commit the cash. Some of those nations had plenty of cash, including India. They'd rather spend it on something else. So you have to take decisions like that, and they took the wrong decision. The same with New Orleans. They had plenty of warning of a problem there, and it's a complete fiasco from one end of it to the other. We do not want to get into that situation with this influenza business. Now, if you go back to 1889, the so-called Russian outbreak, that was the first kind of well-documented outbreak in the world, and it was quite a big outbreak. You can read Winston Churchill's poem about it. He was 15 when he wrote that poem. It's not a bad poem for a 15-year-old. It's just called influenza. And he described how it came across, this virus, carried across, flew across, westwards, across the Caucasian mountains. Even the might of the British Empire couldn't stop it, was how he put it, until it hit Britain and hit the rest of the world. And then hardly had they got over that before the 1918 outbreak. Now, the point is, and then 1957, 1968. The point is, then, we've seen all this before. They've all been caused by bird viruses. 1918, 1957, 1968, what's new? Well, the new thing is, there's quite a long time has gone since 1968, and we're just preparing for the first one in the 21st century. It's as simple as that. We know what's happened in the past. We know it will happen in the future. But also, on top of that, using science now, only science, not soothsaying, not asking priests and God and all that sort of stuff, it's science is going to get us out of this mess. So, and that's basic public health. So we know there have been problems in the past. We can see this virus, this H5N1 virus, moving around in the world. It's moving faster than any of us would have thought. We don't think it's going to move with a mortality of 40%. That'd be impossible for a common or garden virus like influenza. It will reduce its mortality, increase its infectiousness, and get on the move. Whether it will do it this year, next year, or the year after is a moot point. That doesn't matter. I mean, I was thinking this morning, when have I ever woken up in the morning worrying whether there's going to be a flood up the Thames? I never have, because I don't need to, because there's a barrier. You know, it was invested with my money. And when have any of you ever woken up in the morning worrying about contaminated sewage and water? You won't, because 100 years ago, 120 years ago, politicians in this city tore this place apart to install the water systems and the sewers, and we're still benefiting from it now. They tore London apart on a scientific basis. And the scientific basis was a discovery only a few years before of microbes. They took that idea, they took that scientific piece of knowledge, and they went with it. They did not sit back and sit and keep their fingers crossed. They took action. And I do see, when I look around the world, a lot of these politicians and people who control the funds sitting here with their fingers crossed or sitting on their hands hoping it's going to be someone else's problem. And the World Health Organization has asked every country, begged every country, basically, all 250 of them, not to ignore this, to take it seriously. And I would say, here, I think the Department of Health and the HPA have an accolade from WHO with the action they've taken. And that's rather a good thing. I mean, other countries haven't taken any action at all. And I've seen some of their plans. They can be the side of a piece of paper like that, or they can be like a textbook thrown at you. But at least here, and in some European countries, there's a proper plan, and there's a proper kind of ammunition box, if you like, with new drugs, vaccines, and all this sort of thing. So, yes, I don't understand the risk analysis, but I view this as a public health problem. I think we have to take it seriously. Then we can just relax, just like we've done with the Thames barrier.
Thomas, are you relaxing?
Absolutely. Actually, I'm very glad that this is being held at the Hong Kong Theatre. How appropriate. It's wonderful. I mean, there's a whole many, many ideas, and I'd like to unpick some of them, really. I think, Bridget, you started by asking whether the world is better prepared today than it's been earlier. Now, I'm not a public health person. My area really is health communication, but I have lived through SARS. Hong Kong has lived through, it's got 150, almost 200 years now of experience with epidemics. It recorded the first human cases of bird flu in 1997. So I think it's a society where there's a high degree of awareness about what bird flu is, the possibility of a human pandemic. And so I think, and it is a small and wealthy society, so clearly Hong Kong is well prepared for that. But if you look at other parts of the world, and if you look at Asia, look at Africa, and I think there are genuine dilemmas there. Recently, I met a doctor in the Kenyan Public Health Service, and he's worried about bird flu, but he said, listen, for us, it's a hard choice. I mean, if we are going to stock up even a basic minimum of Tamiflu, which would cover, say, 20% of the population, that's our 2 years' health budget. And what happens to all our other programs? What happens to malaria? What happens to tuberculosis? What happens to basic childhood diseases? So I think there is a genuine dilemma, right? Influenza, a pandemic, can be, if it does happen, it will be a terrible thing. But there are people in many parts of the world who are living through, well, the equivalent of pandemics right now. Why? Because they don't have drinking water, you don't have access to clean water, you don't have sanitation, you don't have mosquito-proof nets to prevent malaria, right? You don't have access to basic drugs for things like tuberculosis. So I think there is a genuine dilemma in many parts of the world. How much do we prepare for this, right? And if we do prepare for this, where do we take resources away from? And I don't think there is an answer for this. I mean, in the wealthy parts of the world, I think it is easy. You can be prepared for a lot of things, right? You have the resources to do it. You can prepare for pandemics. You can have plans. And all of this is wonderful. But there are going to be parts of the world where this just will not be possible. It's not going to happen, right? And also, I think you had raised a very interesting question, saying that do we look at the risk of pandemics differently in different parts of the world? And definitely, yes, I think. Poorer parts of the world, the way they look, I mean, this is a huge generalization, but in general, you expect a lot less from governments, right? You expect things like this to happen because they've always happened. And you've never had a government which has come to your aid or which has prepared plans for you. You don't have access to medicines, but these things, every generation, these things happen. So people are used to it. And I guess their risk preparedness would be of a different order. You know, you sort of pray to your gods, right? That is your pandemic plan. So different parts of the world are preparing differently for this. I think a pandemic as a threat, I'm not quite sure how to put this, but I think it is a threat of a greater order of magnitude to the industrialized world than to the non-industrialized world. I know this is a huge sweeping statement, and I will try and justify it maybe in the course of the evening. Why? Because I think there are far more important problems, and people are dying of other things already. Yeah. And this was really brought home to me over the last 2 years, seeing what's happened in Southeast Asia, right? Where chicken farmers in Vietnam, in Thailand, in southern China, face the prospects of losing their livelihood, right, to avert a pandemic. And you must ask yourself what these farmers ask themselves. What is this? You are taking away my livelihood today in order to prevent a disease that might or might not happen, and that really is not going to affect me that much, it's going to affect other parts of the world. And let's turn this around. Suppose the greatest risk of pandemic was here in the Western world, right? And it was farmers here who had to cull their stocks in order to prevent a possible pandemic, which was going to affect Asia, Africa. Would people do it? I don't know. It would be a hard sell, right? Now, I'm being deliberately provocative, to indicate that, you know, this is a complex issue, and different parts of the world would look at it differently. It isn't as black and white. I guess the one black and white thing is that if a pandemic does erupt, people are going to die everywhere. But I think the global response also is going to be very different. And I wrote one, and I was really struck by this after the tsunami. The wonderful thing about the tsunami is the aid that came pouring in from the industrialized world to countries in Asia and Southeast Asia. And that was possible because the tsunami really affected a small part of the world. When a pandemic does break out, the entire world is going to be affected, and everybody is going to look after themselves primarily. So you're not going to get this huge outpouring of aid, of help from the Western world or the industrialized world to poorer parts of Asia and Africa. And I think people there are aware of this. And ultimately, I think in this globalized world, this is going to be a situation where it is going to be every country and every society for itself. I know it's pretty bleak, and I'm probably completely wrong, but I think I'll throw that to you.
Thank you. David, do you think that you're facing risks that weren't fully appreciated by your predecessors, and do you think you're better prepared and placed to handle them than they were?
It's a fascinating question. Let me put some context in terms of who I am and who we are as a company, just to give you a perspective in terms of how we look at pandemics. Marsh McLennan Companies has a number of different entities. One of them, Bridget mentioned, which is Marsh, which is a large risk management insurance broking firm. We also have Mercer Human Resource Consulting, who are one of the largest in the world in terms of dealing with people and the human capital, employee benefits, retirement, pensions, and working with companies vis-a-vis their employees. We have a company called Kroll, which is known for a number of different businesses, investigative services, et cetera. But a big part of their business is security business, which also has to do with risk mitigation, working with companies in dealing with risky issues. We have a management consulting company, and we have several others. So we have a variety of different professional services firms. The work that we do with our clients is to talk to them about risk and have a conversation in terms of what can go wrong, how can it go wrong, and what could be the impact on you as a company. So in answer to the question about how we approach risk and how we approach the pandemics, our psyche is really to work with our clients and look at the worst case, because you can't go wrong if you look at it the worst case and you prepare for the worst case. And it's not raising a crisis, or it's not raising pandemonium within an organization. It's really trying to get people very, very focused on how to deal with the worst case scenario, regardless of what it is. As it relates to the pandemics, it came to me in a very strong impact when I was in China just over a year ago. And I was in a small meeting, we had 12 people, and in the meeting we had the chief executives of some of the major European companies that you can imagine in the food business, in the chemicals business, in the automotive business, and there were a few others. And at the end of the meeting, we asked them, and this is probably 15 months ago, we asked them what was their number one concern vis-a-vis China. And we thought that the answer would be, we have the Beijing Olympics coming, and we're concerned about conflict with Taiwan and potentially an impact on taking advantage of the games that was being built up, obviously, for Beijing. And to a person around that table, they all said the avian flu, the pandemics. That was their number one concern. And these are people who have, you know, been in China for 20, 25 years. Most of them were Western. Some of them were Chinese who have worked in different parts of the world. And we came back and thought that through and called one of them back. And he explained to us that it had reached a point in his mind, in his company's mind. And this is a company that has one of the largest investors in China. They had made a strategic decision over 2 years ago that they felt that they had enough concentration of manufacturing capabilities in China, where that if they were to invest any more, they felt that they would be compromised in terms of being able to maintain a supply of their products and capabilities on a global basis in the event of the pandemics. And as a result of that, they stopped their investment in China, major investment up to that point in time, stopped their investment and redirected it to other parts of the world, Latin America and other places. And when you think about it from a strategic perspective in a corporation, you're actually having to do some discussions at the most senior level in the organization. So it goes beyond the executive team. It goes to the board to say, we're going to take a certain amount of capital and we're going to move it away from what has up until that point in time been the right place to invest it in order to have less concentration of our capabilities. And that's one company. I think when you look at the broad spectrum of companies and our discussions with them when it comes to this risk, it goes back to a point that one of my colleagues was making at the table here this evening, and that is that you can be as prepared as you want to be prepared, but it really eventually comes down to human behavior. And it's the individuals in an organization who will either look at their current crisis plans or their business continuity plans and say, we've done our homework, we're ready, versus those who actually look at that and take a different perspective and say, this one could be different than what we would have anticipated or planned for previously. And that comes to mind very clearly when you look at every little item that could go wrong or that could happen, a degradation of services, lack of communication, a slowly erosion of people disappearing from work because they're not there, the healthcare being affected, the supplies of food and water being affected. Again, it's not trying to go into a crisis mode, but trying to think about everything that could possibly go wrong that could have an impact on a group of individuals that have to make decisions on behalf of their company and on behalf of the employees that they employ. And the lessons that we're learning from this discussion have to do more about not concentrating on the written procedure that an organization has, but focusing more on how you get a group of individuals to work effectively as a team, regardless of what can happen. Because you don't know what all the details are going to be. You don't know what the impacts will be. But you need people that are going to be able to effectively communicate, coordinate, and work with each other from across geographies and across disciplines under very difficult circumstances. And that's a complete different exercise as compared to the traditional crisis management or business continuity planning process that a lot of companies are preparing for or have prepared for. So I think to answer the question, the technology, the communication, and the history and the experience is all there, but it still comes back to the human behavior. And I don't think that the human behavior is necessarily that different in the corporate sector than it might be in the private sector or the government sector, when it comes to individuals banding together. And a final point, we were talking, and Bridget was mentioning this earlier, this is a study which was put together by the World Economic Forum. We contributed to that. There were a lot of people from around the world who contributed to this report, including two other corporations, Merrill Lynch and Swiss Re. And one of the risk mitigation discussions that came at the end of the report, and particularly as it relates to pandemics, was the need for potentially a chief risk officer in government, someone who actually takes responsibility from the government's perspective to coordinate the discussion around the risk assessment, the risk quantification, and how you actually respond to that, and then link in with the private sector so you have some continuity in that piece. And I think that addresses a couple of the points that my colleagues were saying here this evening.
Thank you. Well, there's a range of views emerging, I think, already. And a short question next, in a sense, which is, I underlined earlier that Beck said that risk is about anticipating catastrophe. If you look on the websites today, on the news websites, you get a variety of news items. You get the BBC telling you that H5N1 does not yet pose a large-scale threat to humans. However, experts fear the virus could mutate and trigger a flu pandemic, potentially putting millions of human lives at risk. The same reporting day, you get an IMF report published which concludes that a severe avian flu pandemic would have a significant but short-lived impact on the global economy through its disruption of workforces, transportation, and trade. If the virus caused high levels of illness and death, they report, it is likely there would be a sharp but only temporary decline in global economic activity. The question is, and it's one posed by my colleagues, in this present situation, are we talking about outbreaks or are we talking about chronic risks? Which of those scenarios would one go with? And are we talking about millions of human lives at risk, or are we talking about something that's going to be a temporary blip in the global economy? John, would you like to take that one on board?
I don't know about the global economy. I just want to make one point myself about, I'm not an economist, but we all do appreciate, I mean, you mentioned about some of these countries supposedly that haven't got any cash to hand, but India and China are going to be superpowers. When the United States declines, the next one after the United States is China, and the one after that, India. Or maybe it's the other way around, I can't remember now. But there's plenty of cash around. It's just the lack of, I think, the lack of application. And one other thing there, remember, with the smallpox eradication, to eradicate that disease cost less than putting a man on the moon. And what a total waste of money that was. I mean, the man on the moon, when you come to think about it. And some countries now are fully prepared to put another man on the moon or a woman on the moon when they're not prepared to spend money on public health. That's what really gets me. Now, to come back to your point, sorry. What was it now? such a complicated
are we
query.
Outbreaks or chronic risk?
All the predictions are with this... with an outbreak in the looking back to the previous ones in the last century and what we anticipate will happen now or soon or whenever is a sharp outbreak of about 5 or 6 weeks. So I read that report in the Financial Times today and I thought it made perfect sense. We're talking here about a wave. It's like throwing a pebble in a pond. You get a wave and then another wave and then another one. She would talk about a big wave. People will be ill on any one day. There won't be more than say 5% of people ill. It's not as though half the population are going to be ill. That wouldn't make sense. Even in 1918, it didn't make sense. So you can imagine, like a bank holiday, you go outside, and the fewer students here are all on holiday. It won't be worse than that, but it'll last for about 5 weeks. And if you're prepared, if your business, if they're all not going to sit at home worrying about it, looking at their toes, if they're going to come in and carry on, then the thing's okay. If they start worrying, the whole society will grind to a halt, as it did in Hong Kong. There was no need for that panic in Hong Kong with a SARS outbreak, because only 1 in 10,000 people were ever infected. It was a complete panic of a modern society all going berserk. And that's what we have to avoid. And and the way to avoid that is to make sure that everyone understands that there's a plan and everyone will be looked after. And that's why I think some of these Western European countries have got it just right, because everyone will begin to know they don't need to stock up on any of these drugs, because there's enough stockpiled by the government to look after them, because not more than a quarter of the population is going to be ill in total, and there's going to be enough drug for everyone. You don't need to stack sardine cans or sugar under your floorboards and all that sort of thing, because everything will be okay. It will not be a New Orleans situation. These are organized communities.
Tom.
Yeah, I don't know in terms of outbreak and chronic. I want to go back basically to when we're talking about this, things like this, we're really talking about uncertain events. And to be honest, these are all scenarios. These are planning scenarios. How is this going to pan out? What is the likely effect going to be on the global economy? How will people react? Clearly, initially, there will be panic. I think there will be panic in every society because this is something new. It is frightening. And I think they say this about war. Your battle plans last only until the first bullet is fired. And once in the heat of battle, the first thing that disappears is the plan. And I hope this doesn't happen. But having actually lived through a society which is faced with an unknown, with an epidemic of unknown origins, no known treatment. I mean, the first couple of weeks were really very, they were not terrifying, but I think people were genuinely scared. And doctors were scared, the public health officials were scared, because science is really not very good at explaining the unknown. And this really was, SARS was an unknown disease. I think a pandemic influenza would be very different, because this is something that people have been prepared for. They know what it is. You can anticipate, you know how to manage from a public health point of view. But still, there will be widespread panic. And why? Because your normal patterns of living are going to have to change radically. Everybody is going to be scared, because just doing your job is going to be far riskier, it's going to be far more dangerous than it normally is. And because each time you go out in the streets, you fear you may be risking your life. And I'm not just talking about doctors and health professionals, I mean, clearly they are risking their lives, but anybody. Just going to the office, going to work, sharing a tube, sharing a bus with somebody, and that could be risky. So everybody, I mean, if there is a pandemic, each and every one of us is going to have to adjust. From the experience of Hong Kong, all of us, I think the first week or so is really going to be quite scary, because you don't know. Can you send your kids to school? Should they go out to play? Right? Or should they stay at home? Should you go to work? Right? And these are all questions for which there really are no ready answers, because these are questions that, even if the government tells you something, ultimately these are decisions that you find you take on your own, right? Or you take with your family or with your friends and based on your own best interest. So the point is, when this actually does happen, it is going to be tremendous uncertainty. There is going to be panic. And I think after the first couple of weeks, things will settle down. When both at a social level and at an individual level, people learn how to cope. You change your living patterns, you don't go out, you don't see your friends anymore, you sort of chat on the internet, you stop going out to dinner, all of that. But initially it is going to be a shock. And the economic shock, or the shock to the global economy, really would be in the first couple of weeks, when societies across the world adjust, I think, to this new reality. From a public health point of view, I guess it will happen in waves and so on. But society's responses do not always mirror what is happening on the ground in terms of how the epidemic is progressing, because I think it's a little slower, because people take a little longer to react, to something happening. And sorry, what I've done really is to try and paint a picture of what it might be like based on the SARS experience in Hong Kong, which really doesn't answer your question of whether this is going to be an outbreak or whether we're talking about something chronic. So, and the answer to that is really, I don't know. Why? Because it's it is uncertain. And I think the scientists probably are much, much better prepared for this. But one thing I think is fairly easy to say is that if you look at the record of the last two decades, and if you look at the way, at the number of new emerging infectious diseases, from viruses that we hadn't even heard of before, if you look at what's happening, SARS really was just the latest of an example of this phenomenon. I think this is something that we're going to have to live with for several generations, I think. As our relationship with nature changes, I think we are going to be more and more prone to new diseases, new viral diseases, bacterial diseases, all sorts of diseases. And I think this is something that, we had forgotten about infectious diseases. We got this wake-up call. I guess HIV/AIDS was a wake-up call, but that was a very long-drawn wake-up call. With SARS, we got a very sharp wake-up call. And I think this is the way we're going to get, there are going to be others as well, things that we haven't even thought of yet. So yes, in a sense, I think this is going to be a long-term chronic issue.
Okay, thank you. You did partly answer Beck's question about whether or not this was about anticipation of risk with mm-hmm. your or portrayal of the probability of panic. Peter, did our predecessors have a notion of chronic risk? Did they panic?
Not nearly in the same way, but as a humble historian, I don't think that talking about our predecessors in this case adds much value to the discussion here, whether it's going to affect us sort of as short hit or whether it's going to be something much more sort of low grade. So in the time-honored traditions of debates, if I may, I would like to sort of put my oar in here, not precisely what you're asking me, but on an issue that I see simmering here between my two co-debaters, Thomas and...
I wouldn't want you to pull away from answering the question entirely, because there is a point there that's made by a number of serious academics in the area, that actually the anticipation of risk is something that's new, and as a historian, you may have something to say on that, which would be helpful,
I think. I'll meet you halfway.
Yeah.
There is obviously a sense in which the more we know, the more we have to worry about. And if we have less, we know less. But on the other hand, there's equally clearly a sense in which knowing more allows you to take certain kinds of risks off the table. I mean, if you think of the difference between the year 999 and the year 1999, and the worries we were concerned with, in 999 it was the question of, is the world coming to an end? And is the second coming about to arrive? In the year 1999, the question was, are we going to get stuck in an elevator on New Year's Eve? Mm. I do think we have the fact that we have a sort of more secularized approach to this allows us to take certain anticipations of risk that once were very real in the minds of the average person off the table, and perhaps we replace them with other forms of risk on top of that. But my naive Enlightenment belief would be that, generally speaking, we are dealing in a more clear-sighted way with risks than we were before, and even if we have more things to worry about, we do so in a more sensible fashion. Which brings me now, if you'll allow me to do this elision, to the question of risk management, which I think is was brought off in the first question and then in a sense sort of shunted off, because John suggested that risk management meant that one should worry about things like whether or not a tsunami happens again, and that there's plenty of cash in places like India and China to deal with these problems, and that it was a mistake to do so. With all due respect to your feelings as a parent and the danger that your daughter was, and to obviously the people who died in it, it seems to me that what risk management, and again, I'm not an expert on this, but it seems to me that what it precisely seeks to do is to decide where is it most rational to put our resources, given that we don't have enough resources to deal with all risks that we face or think that we face. And that in the case of something like tsunami, it seems highly unlikely that it's actually going to be worth it to do something like set up some sort of warning system. The day after Vesuvius obliterated Pompeii, I'm sure voices should have been able to have been heard, whatever case that is, saying what we need now is a volcano warning system. And all the money that would have gone into that would, of course, have been completely a waste, because it hasn't happened since, and who knows whether it will, and even if it did, the technology would have been endlessly outmoded by the time it did. They would have whipped the horses into sending the messages off or whatever they would have implemented back then. If we are applying some sort of risk management analysis to this, then there are things that we should be worrying about, and they are chronic diseases in the third world. They are not the 300,000 people who die in the earthquake in Pakistan and the tsunami on Boxing Day. They are the million who die of malaria every year. They are the 2 million who die of tuberculosis, the 3 million who die of AIDS, and that sort of thing. And that is, in a sense, why one of the most enlightened, as far as I can tell, feats of applied risk management is the Gates Foundation, whose mission statement, as I understand it, is something like to save the most lives for the least money, and who therefore have found this to be the case where they get most bang for the buck. Most bang for the buck, of course, is not a technical economic term, but it is essentially what risk management is about. Where do we put it in? And we are, of course, as a society, however enlightened and modern and scientific, totally irrational about judging risk. We spend millions upon millions of dollars removing the last minute trace of some chemical substance from our food at the same time that we allow people to smoke or take all kinds of other insane risks. We worry about airplanes and get into our cars without giving it a second thought. We are not good judges of risk, but risk management ought to push us in that direction.
David, you're in the business of risk management. Are you feeding off the fears? Are you fueling them? Or are you helping?
I have no idea. I really have no idea. I'm going to be upfront on it. I have no idea what the impact will be. And I have confidence, though, in two things. I have confidence, one, in the resilience of the human being and of economies of coming through. If you look at history and you look at major events that have taken place, people have been able to deal with them and get on with life. And so there's a comfort factor as a human being to have that in mind. The second point has to do also with, I think, what's happened in the labor force in the last 20 years. The last 20 years have been very, very difficult for employees as corporations have changed and come under more competition. There's been all kinds of evolutions in technology and others that have impacted work, where the concept 20 years ago of basically you join a company, you're there for life, has absolutely disappeared. So people have dislocation as part of their reality in the year 2006. It's very difficult to expect people to be with the same company, whether they start today and in 30 years they'll still be with that company, or if they've been with the company for 15 years and where they'll be, and it's probably the same in other parts of society. So in people's psyche and their structure and the way that they experience life and the realities around life, I think people recognize that change is inevitable. And as a consequence of that, I think people as individuals, combined with the fact that there is resilience as a result of that and also with the economies, they'll be able to bounce back. There's also been some stress tests on the financial systems as a result of numerous near catastrophes in the last 15 years on the monetary side. And they've actually done some stress testing as it relates to the stock exchanges and a number of other financial instruments in the event of a pandemic case. And they feel that the system will be able to survive and will be able to move forward, and the contingency plans in place they feel very comfortable with. And this has been a tremendous amount of work around that space. So to answer the question, I don't know, but I feel that we'll get through it one way or another. But obviously those who, as individuals and as organizations, whether they're corporates or governments, who are prepared and have gone through a process of thinking about the worst case and being able to apply some of the knowledge that they have and are linked in with others, will be in better off condition than others. And just one last point, it's also touching on the media. I think there's a role that the media has to play in terms of crisis management and the dispersal of information. And it's very difficult in this day and age with 24-hour news television and everybody that's focusing in on issues. It becomes primetime television 24 hours a day. And it's very difficult when you have a reporter who's out there in the field and who wants to be able to say something and has to say something, and it can't always be the same thing. And we see this time and time again. We saw that in London in the bombs that we had in June and July. We've seen this in the tsunami. We've seen this in 9/11 in the United States. We've seen it again and again. So we can't forget the media. They're an important source of being able to provide the right information at the right time and just enough information, but there has to be an equilibrium there with government and the private sector in terms of making sure the facts are correct so that you don't create alarmism amongst the people.
Thank you. I mean, one of the key features that's coming out through this debate is, of course, that pandemics now are seen as global, and it may be one of the key features now is that we're talking about a global risk. We see them that way partly, as David's pointing out, because we are much more aware of their global nature through the media and through reporting. And also there's greater concern perhaps around because of the greater transnational activity, which may in itself exacerbate the risk of, for example, a pandemic. And this raises questions around risk management, at what level it happens. But one concern in the present scenario is that the traditional instruments of the state are not necessarily very capable when it comes to managing the risks that we face now in a globalized world. Peter, is that one that you'd like to take on risk management?
Very happy to. I think there are two things to be said about the question of the traditional instruments of the state in a globalized world. And the first has to do with the question of globalization in the first place. I suspect that if something like this really happens, that we will become unglobalized very quickly, perhaps not for very long, but certainly there will be a major clampdown of travel and economic communication around the world. And it seems to me that we should be asking ourselves some questions. For example, is it really every West European citizen's birthright to be allowed to take two or three 6,000-mile jet-fueled vacations every year? Is this really sort of something that everyone has to do? Is the indiscriminate moving of human biomass around the globe really one of sort of the achievements of modern civilization that we are willing to sort of pay a price that includes something like the possible spread of pandemic in order to enjoy? It may be that the answer is yes. Certainly the fact that the tourism and hospitality industries are, by certain measures, among the largest, if not the largest, single industries in many economies, some 10% of many economies, speaks against any clamping down on this. Certainly the fact that there are 500 million Indians and Chinese with middle-class incomes just waiting to come online as tourists speaks against any ability to clamp down on this. But at the same time, that the ability of new media technologies, new means of communication, allow us for the first time really in human history not to travel. It seems to me at least worth posing the question, is this particular aspect of globalization one that is not perhaps going to be checked by something like the threat of a pandemic? I put that simply as a question because, of course, I don't know the answer to that. So that I'm not quite sure about the globalization. But assuming for the moment that globalization remains an issue for pandemics, I think that not only are the traditional state powers capable of doing that, I think it is precisely where traditional state powers have lacked that we have a problem. Consider the stories in the news the other day that in some facility in Nigeria where chickens were being disposed of, the ones that were posed a threat, this facility was stormed by hungry farmers who wanted their chickens back and who were intending to eat them. Consider the fact that in Turkey and China, one of the questions raised has been whether or not the reporting has been accurate enough to give us a sense of the epidemic early enough in its spread. And it seems to me the question is, the danger is not from not applying traditional state powers, it is precisely from underperforming states. Conversely, those states that have taken decisive measures have done so in a completely traditional fashion. We are essentially imposing the same sorts of measures that were imposed against the plague in the Middle Ages and certainly against cholera and diseases in the 19th century. We're imposing reporting, notification, isolation, disinfection, decontamination, all the things that Venice in the 15th century would have understood completely, would have known how to apply. Sometimes there are some technological improvements. There are thermal scanners in the airport at Singapore during the SARS epidemic. But basically, what is being done is very much what used to be done. And in fact, our armamentarium of tools, our toolkit, hasn't really changed dramatically, it seems to me, with a few technical upgrades since the perfection of smallpox vaccination in the late 19th century. So I think what we need is not to worry about the traditional instruments of the state. We need to make sure that they are, in fact, being enforced.
Okay, thank you. Thomas, what are your views about the structure of international governance?
Yeah. I think SARS and AIDS have really demonstrated that, I mean, disease is global, and I think the example of SARS in China also demonstrated that governments that cover up are going to pay an extremely heavy price because everybody knows that they're covering up. And in today's day and age, no country is going to be able to can afford to do that. So I think disease is one more of the things that have been chipping away at the traditional notions of sovereignty. You know, the sort of the state as a billiard ball. It doesn't exist anymore. And this, I mean, the global economy has proved this. Concern about issues like human rights have proved it, and disease proves it as well. And there are certain global standards, because disease is global, there are certain global standards that every state is going to have to adhere to if it wants to be an effective member of the international community. The other interesting thing, I think, is that disease, like any catastrophe, is extremely political. And I think governments are going to rise, they're going to live or die according to how well they prepare or how well they cope with the pandemic. there is going to be, governments that do not cope well with a pandemic are not going to survive long. I mean, there is a political cost to governments. I mean, purely from the point of view of their own interest in staying in power, there is a political cost to failure. And I think everybody realizes that. So I think, first of all, it is something, disease is global now, and this is, ideas of national sovereignty are really irrelevant as far as disease is concerned. And secondly, even if you look at domestic politics, people will judge their governments by the way that they deal with this pandemic, especially in most modern industrial societies, most countries, I think. And there are countries where people don't expect anything from their governments, and their governments have never delivered anything, and they're clearly not going to start once in the midst of a pandemic. And so take those out of the equation. But for all modern societies, I think the political survival of governments require that they be prepared and that they handle this, because people do expect this from them.
Thank you. David, does business have confidence in national and international government structures?
I think there's a couple of thoughts that cross my mind. The first one is, I think that governments, if you look back at a number of events, governments are good at responding at the immediate event, the immediate crisis. It galvanizes all the different forces. You bring people together. You make a big impact. Where it's much more difficult is in the longer term after effects, how you deal with the consequences of the impact. And we've seen that again, time and time again. And that's perhaps difficult to prepare for, because it's financially costly and organizationally difficult, because you're uncertain of all the aspects that could be involved. But I think that's an issue, because this is a event that could potentially last for a long time, and it's not the immediate event, because this is going to be, it's not a big band, a big explosion. It's going to be a creeping, slowly evolving situation, which is going to take a lot of time, whether it's weeks, months, or beyond that. And so that's not a natural approach for governments, from my perspective, in the way that they deal with issues. The second point I'd like to make is that governments sometimes have the best plans but are not able to actually deploy all the resources necessary with the right instruments at the right time. I lived in Mexico for many years, and I was in Mexico City in the earthquake of 1985. And the Mexican government had a very sophisticated response plan for earthquakes in Mexico City. And they would deploy the military on motorcycles, and they all had pre-allocated zones to be able to go and report back, because the communications would be devastated, as they were. And it worked extraordinarily well. And they came back and they identified all the buildings that had broken down, the roads that weren't working, the areas that needed some support. And the next wave went out from the military and other services to go to those spots. The problem is that they arrived with guns. They had no shovels, they had no lights, they had no drills, they had no equipment to be able to deal with the impact of what had happened. And that's not dissimilar to what happens in other locations or other countries. So my fear is, or my concern is, that it's this long-term effect, medium to long-term effect of the aftermath. How do you deal with that? How do you sustain the ability to be able to cope daily with these issues? And then it comes up to leadership. Do we have the right leadership in all the different governments actually to be able to step up and help deal with a crisis? And then the final point is, I think there's more important in this situation, perhaps in many, many others, is this need for dialogue between the different governments, because you've got to connect the scientific community, the medical community, and others across the world to be able to deal with the issues as they will come out from this particular event. And that needs a lot of trust and a lot of good communication, a lot of partnership between individuals, which is not naturally there on a global scale.
Thank you. John, from a scientific perspective, national, international governance, does it help?
Well, I don't know about scientific point of view. I think John Donne put it pretty well with his poem, No Man Is an Island. And he's an Elizabethan poet who seems to have recognized things that we don't even recognize now, sitting in 2006, it seems to me. That is, we're in a global situation here. Your point about travel, It won't make one iota of difference if you stop people travelling on the spread of this virus. I mean, it spread quite nicely in 1918. There wasn't an aircraft in sight. So I don't think you should start targeting middle class anyone or other and their right to fly. It's not make one iota of difference at all. And I know the politicians, their first thing is going to say, right, what we'll do is we'll stop every foreigner coming into the country from Southeast Asia. But that's not make one smidgen of difference. And it's all been worked out. I mean, the Department of Health have worked that out. You can stop 99.9% of the flights coming into England. All you do is, first of all, you'll cripple your economy, and secondly, you'll delay the virus arriving by a couple of weeks. So, you know, there has to be a clear message. And I think, again and again, what we're missing here is that scientific knowledge is not being listened to, and then, even worse than that, it's not being used and translated into action. And I go back to this tsunami thing. I went there. I saw the minister there a couple of months ago. They're all spending money. Every nation that doesn't have any money at all. I mean, you arrive in Colombo, and the place is bristling with the army and machine guns. They're just spending the money on the wrong things. And they are now prepared to spend £25 million, which is a smidgen of money. And they're all squabbling about it now. India wants to do it. Sri Lanka wants to do all this and that. They're all putting their tsunami warning systems up. But fact is, they should have done it before. Now, I disagree as well about Vesuvius. Just because you've had a volcano eruption, you know, you might make a joke about it, but again, that is a warning. You shouldn't have people sitting there, and they are sitting there now. And we all recognise it's a risk on those volcanoes. It's just that there's very weak government in Italy and Sicily, and they can't do anything about it, and they jolly well should do something, because one of those volcanoes will erupt and catch all those people sitting there. So it's weak government and lack of action, I think, rather than anything else. What else? That's about it, I think, actually. I think it's John Dunn. I mean, to be taught a lesson by John Dunn is quite something, all these years later.
Before we open it up to the floor, I'm going to invite Dr. Jane Lees, who's Senior Medical Officer at the Department of Health, to respond to the debate so far. She plays some part in, I think, the UK's response to any so-called threat of pandemic at the moment, and she's been listening keenly, taking lots of notes, and you're going to respond first. They're going to bring you a mic here.
Thank you very much. It's certainly been a very interesting debate. Now, I, like John Oxford, come to this from a public health perspective, but I've been working in the national government public health for about 15 years now, and this is the first time that I have known such extensive preparation for an infectious disease event. And it's extended not just from the Department of Health to, as we have heard, pretty well every sector of society is now beginning to think of what plans they need to put in place. One of the things that has struck me from the discussion is we have not discussed what we regard as success or failure in management of a future pandemic. And we have some tools that are better than before. We're not entirely dependent on 16th century medicine. But we may not have too much. And will populations become very angry at governments for not being able to mitigate the effects of a pandemic as much as we think we should be able to handle infectious diseases in the 21st century? I think that still is an open question. We're trying to marshal science as much as we can to improve what we can do and to develop technologies that we can get quickly at the time. But there are still many uncertainties about that. And so although we can calculate risks, there's a lot of mathematical modeling going on about risks, there still are a huge number of uncertainties which are going to be difficult to handle.
Thank you very much. Now, I want to open up the questioning to you all now. You've heard a range of views, some of them competing, some disagreements. I know a number of you in the audience actually hold policy-making positions yourselves, and others have written about this topic in their own right. So who would like to start questioning? Back here. if you could say who you are first, that would be helpful.
Indeed. My name is Diana Newcomb, and I'm actually involved at the moment in preparing business continuity plans for a company that I work for in the healthcare sector. But I wanted to pick up on this broader question of whether or not the impact economically would be severe or not, because it seems to me that I think while I initially started coming at this with the proposition that this was going to perhaps be a 5, 6, 8 week interlude whilst people were away during the initial phase of wave of flu, I've come to the conclusion that actually I think it's far more severe, likely to be far more severe impact upon the economy, and perhaps more severe on the economy than it ever would in terms of our management of the issue as people. And the reason why I've come to that conclusion is this. Firstly, I think supply chain, both internationally and domestically, must be compromised. At least those of you who can tell know that I come from Australia, and I know that Australia's policy is basically to shut its doors. That will have little effect, probably, in terms of stopping the pandemic, but it will certainly impact dramatically in terms of things like movement of goods. I think that that is a likely response from many countries around the world. And even if that's not the case, I've spoken to large pharma companies, for example, who expect there to be significant difficulties in obtaining goods either to manufacture product or the finished products themselves. Even if supply chain isn't compromised, cash flow probably will be, because you're talking about significant periods of time where even if people adjust in the same way they might do in wartime, we're not going to engage in the same buying and selling practices that we do normally. I'm not going to go to Topshop and try on a garment that 10, 20, 30 other people have tried on before me. I'm just not going to do that. Coming in and out of central London will probably be something that's either not advised in terms of use of public transport, or even if it is accepted and transport continues, I'm not going to want to use it. In private healthcare, I'm not going to want to particularly go into hospital for elective surgery and open myself up to the chance of infection there. So all of these things will impact on cash flow, and then most businesses that I know can't withstand major cash flow shortages for significant periods, even if they could cope with the fact that they haven't got staffing. So I think that will be very significantly disruptive. And the one thing I really just wanted to, suppose, throw out there is that it seems to me that government policy making, which has been very intensely focused on this issue, has missed a trick in that we probably, if we ended up with severe economic disruption, end up in a much more localised focus. We'll be engaged in local trading because we won't be able to access things from other regions. We might be wanting to barter or engage more with small communities. And in that, it seems to me that government might be able to assist in helping to develop our thinking about how we might do that, how we could use the internet effectively to support those mechanisms, how we could develop those sorts of things amongst ourselves. And we could wait until it's a disaster, or we could assume that it won't be a disaster, or we could start to think, how could we actively manage economic catastrophe, even if it's something that only lasts for a few years now. Just wanted to finish with the fact that I was asking, as many people have asked me, for my pandemic plan recently. I was asking for a company that manages pension funds, and they presented a lovely pension plan to me, pandemic plan, which said, you know, people will manage this about our staff, and they'll be able to work remotely and yada yada yada. And I said, yes, but the issue is you're managing millions of pounds worth of pension, and if there is even a relatively severe impact on the stock market, that's a big problem for that pension fund. And what are you actually planning to do about that? And the truth was, they haven't. And that's my concern about the level. And I think we're getting now to a chance to be a bit more sophisticated in our thinking. And that's what I wanted to sort of, I suppose, put out there tonight.
Thanks. Thank you. Does anyone want to follow that question up? We'll put them both to the panel.
Can I just respond? It's from the Hong Kong now.
Once more, I agree with you entirely, but once more from the Hong Kong and the East Asian experience, I mean, all economic activity is cyclical. And sure, people will stay at home for a while, but once it's over, they are going to start spending, and they will spend with a vengeance. So you will get an upturn, I mean, and a fairly sharp upturn. The other thing is lots of businesses actually will do well. Home entertainment. People are going to be sitting at home. right? And there are a number of businesses which actually are going to do pretty well, right? Because, I mean, it really depends on how devastating this is. But the break on economic activity, unlike during a war, when infrastructure is destroyed, people are literally, lives are being lost and so on. Here, economic activity is slowing down because people are choosing not to spend money or not to indulge in certain kinds of productive activity, right? But the capacity is there, and they are going to do it the minute it is over, even though it may be fairly prolonged. So clearly there will be a sharp downturn, but there will also be an equally sharp upturn, I think, probably even sharper, because what happens when it's over is that, you know, you get exuberance of the most irrational kind, and people just go and spend. So I agree with everything that you said, but you might want to factor that in as well, too.
I don't think one should over-exaggerate, actually, the effects of this outbreak. I mean, in a group this size, you would hardly expect anyone to die. It's not as though anyone's anticipating half the population are going to die, just because the mortality is 40% now, it will not be by the time this virus begins to move, or indeed any influenza virus begins to move. That's number one thing. Number two thing is, and the second thing is, all this science and application and preparation is to reduce illness, reduce the spread of the virus, maybe even stop it moving out from the first place. I mean, for the first time in history, one could utilize some of these scientific advances, these new drugs, and actually try and swamp an outbreak when it's beginning and stop it. So there is the possibility of aborting the first pandemic of the 21st century. That's what we're all aiming for. That's what the World Health Organization is aiming for. We're not necessarily going to sit here and take it. The idea is to put all the resources in and try and stop it in the first place. That's the application of science and public health. It's completely different from what it was like in 57, 68, when none of us knew anything about it. We didn't know where the virus came from, and we wait until the Sunday Times, I think it was, journalist, told us that there was an outbreak in Hong Kong. That's different from what it's going to be, I'm sure, this time. It might be not so different about the journalists telling us there's an outbreak, but there's a much more positive attitude. I'm the scientific director of a small SME, small medium enterprise. We've got 20 employees, and we sometimes laugh that we're the smallest group in Britain with a pandemic plan. And our pandemic plan is to carry on as usual. That's our pandemic plan. That people, fair enough, you needn't come in a rush hour, come in early or come in late, but we will expect every member of that staff to be in. We won't expect any of them to be sitting at home looking at their toes, worrying that they're going to get infected on the tube. Because, I mean, it's like Hong Kong in the reality with the SARS. You had to meet 10,000 people in Hong Kong until you met one who was infected. And that's why it was so preposterous. You had all these young people running around in the streets with masks on. First of all, there's no chance of picking up that virus in the street anyway, unless you've got within about an inch of someone's nose. So there are some scientific realities with all these outbreaks. And I think that's what I continually find, that the thing just takes into the atmosphere without the science being kind of thought about. So our plan is we will behave as normal in this company. We don't expect anyone to be at home worrying. There is a course of antiviral for every member of the company that we bought about 2 years ago before the price went up. And it will be, and we have a diagnostic kit for every member, so they will be able to diagnose themselves with the kit and utilize the drug as early as possible. But we do expect them, nevertheless, to continue working if they've not infected, they're not showing symptoms, and everyone's been trained to do two jobs.
Thank you. Do I have a few minutes?
Including me.
No, I completely agree with what you said and the process and the fact that I see absolutely a containment within countries of goods and people. That's absolutely going to happen. You talk about the cash and potential barter. I think that could evolve. It goes back to the point right when you ended. The comment that stuck in my mind is it depends on how long this goes. It really depends on how long this goes in terms of the impact. And one of the analyses was the fact that cash machines will run out because they won't have the people actually to go and fill the cash machine. So how are you going to pay for goods? Assuming the credit cards and all those continue to work and you get your paychecks even if you're not able to work. The bigger concern that I have from a corporate perspective is when the antidote, the vaccination, something comes out from the scientific community and it's given to the pharmaceutical companies to say, you will mass produce these because we need to get them out quickly. this is going to be the first time that governments are going to have to step up and take the potential liability of the consequences 1 year, 5 year, 10 years out of what that drug potentially could do to the companies or to the individuals. Because the companies are going to be very concerned of liabilities, as you could imagine, in the pharmaceutical industry. And they will be doing the right thing based on the realities at that point in time and the evidence of the scientific community, but be mandated by government actually, and I'm sure that they want to, produce these in mass quantities and distribute them around the world, opens up a whole new era of potential litigation on the liability side. So there's going to be all kinds of those kinds of issues that have to be discussed and understood between governments and the private sector.
Thank you. Henry.
To ask John Oxford here, I'm a bit confused because on the one hand, you're describing this virus which will sweep the world very easily, whatever you do, virtually. On the other hand, you're saying, don't worry, certainly not in this country, there is a plan, and this is to quote you, everyone will be looked after. Now, your company has stocks of Tamiflu or Relenza or whatever it is. I don't know whether, I work here at LSE, I don't know whether we do here at LSE, perhaps somebody here could reassure me or not. But that kind of planning only really works if everybody else does it. And I think, as we've heard from many in the audience and on the panel, it's pretty clear that not everybody is going to do this. So kind of, how can these plans really work when society is pretty complex, organisations do things in all sorts of perverse ways? And we look at foot-and-mouth epidemic and so forth, we can see how government cocks up sometimes, you know, and can we really be sure that this is going to happen?
Yeah, well, this is what this is all about. I mean, for the first time in history, we're all sitting here preparing for an outbreak. That's never happened before, and we're totally wasting our time if we don't get anywhere. That's my point here. You know, not in 1968, not in 1957, not in 18 did people sit around in a room in every office in the country, the Department of Health working his butt off, and the HPA, in anticipation for an outbreak. You know, if they could have done that, maybe they could have stopped it. So, and there's no, you know, this is all positive stuff. It's applying. I agree with Jane. We're in a society now which has made huge advances with vaccines and antiviral drugs. We haven't quite worked out how to use them often. And that's never more the case than with influenza. There are these drugs, and we haven't, to a large extent, worked out exactly how they're going to be used. That's going to come, I think, and pretty fast, probably. But you can do your best, I think. It's like being on an aircraft, you know, and down comes the oxygen thing, and it says, well, you do your own first, then you sort out your nip. And I think to some extent that's what one has to do here. You organise your own little house first. In other words, we organise ourselves here in England. We try and help Europe organise itself, which it's doing. I think England's pretty organised now. It wasn't 18 months ago, but a huge effort's been put into it. And a lot of European countries are at least as organised as us now, perhaps a little bit more. Other countries, Japan, Australia, some leading lights. The United States is pretty lagging behind. They haven't done anything, basically. There are some countries in Southeast Asia which are pretty lagging behind, too. But there are examples that have been made to the world, and other countries, we hope, will look up and say, what's all the fuss about in England? Well, that's not so bad. Let's follow along. You know, we can't be expected here to police the whole world and in order them around. That's not our job. But on the other hand, the attitude is different, and the change in attitude has been led by the World Health Organization. They did not realize what power they had until the SARS outbreak. They didn't realize they could bring a nation to its knees. And I remember reading in the Financial Times, they were pretty upset about it when they realized an organization like WHO could bring a country to its knees. And it did almost in Hong Kong, because it was this business of not declaring, trying to cover up on things. And so WHO just said, well, stop going to Hong Kong, and the economy almost imploded. So it's got huge power. I know governments have been trying to curtail it since. It's got huge power. It's got the kudos and the reputation that we were all back behind it. And with WHO and the United Nations together, it's those two organizations that are saying, don't just sit and take it, go in and we'll take action. They have got stocks themselves of some of these drugs, and I think they are prepared to use them to try and stop an outbreak. They've got a plan already on how to do this, and it's been fully published in Nature, here in London, from Imperial College. It's at least a scenario. It might seem a bit airy-fairy at this precise moment, but at least the scientific community is saying that we're not going to take this, we're going to apply these things and utilize these drugs and try and stop an outbreak right at the beginning.
Thank you. Any more questions? One back here.
I'm Jesse Fonestock. I'm with the World Economic Forum Global Risk Program that David was referring to. The conversation raised two ideas in my mind, actually. First, the point about governments are going to be punished if they fail on this issue. That's absolutely true, but like most low probability risks, they won't be rewarded if they succeed. And I think that tends to distort the priorities even more than they're already distorted on issues like this. And I also wanted to follow up on the idea of risk management as sort of a rational application of scarce resources. It seems to me if that's the case, and if there are these distributional issues that were referred to, sort of cross-border distributional issues about who's going to be affected, who has to take action, there really is a strong case for the long-term investment in animal health and animal care practices in the developing world by the developed world nations. And I think that's something that maybe isn't talked about. It's not a particularly sexy issue. It's not human health. But it's very important in the long term. We can't have this disease becoming endemic in the animal populations in the developing world either. So I think it's something to consider. I know that the UNFAO is working on those issues and those transfers are happening, but it seems like it's something that deserves a bit more attention.
Thank you. Are there any more questions before we finish? There's one here and one back. Can we take this one first, please?
Can I just ask that about there is a reward for countries that take action and avoid things. It is a legacy. It's a political legacy. And politicians, that's all they have, isn't it? They either make a disaster zone, like the chap who ate hamburgers, to tell us all it was all safe. And what happened to him? They made him a lord. He's sitting happy. But it's not much of a legacy. And every month now, someone else dies of that disease. But really, his legacy is not too good, though he's sitting in the House of Lords. So in a way, their reward is the legacy of they took action at the right moment.
Can we just take the two final questions? There's one in the middle here.
Andrew Empson from DEFRA. I'm here representing myself only. Just want to ask the panel if they're worried about an outbreak in the next 12 months.
Thank you. And a final question. Sorry, for you, up behind you here.
On the question of bird flu mutating causing a human pandemic, can someone give an estimate of a time constant? So what's the risk per unit time of this happening? When people simply say it's inevitable, that's not very, very informative. It would be nice to have a time constant, the hazard rate per unit time.
Thank you. Peter, do you want to answer any of those questions?
Let me just very briefly touch on the issue raised back here that the first world essentially has a stake in animal husbandry or animal care practices in the third world and lots of other practices in the third world. I think that's precisely right. I think that was one of the lessons that began to be learned during the AIDS epidemic and will possibly become acutely evident in whatever it is will happen possibly in the next year or two. And it seems to me that going back to a point raised by Thomas, given that many countries in the third world are unable to do much about this themselves, that in fact what is likely or what ought to happen is of course that the first world pay directly for some of the actions that not only are, as it were, a kind of charitable response to suffering there, but in fact a direct question of self-interest. If you go back and look at the 19th century public health legislation, things like sewerage, zoning laws, ventilation, all the sorts of things that make modern cities possible to live in, a lot of them have to do precisely with improvements paid for by upper middle class strata, precisely so they would not be affected by diseases that were posed to them, dangers posed to them by the lower classes. It's a kind of sort of self-buying kind of insurance policy, if you will, a kind of sort of improvement that benefits everyone, but in fact is motivated by a kind of immediate self-interest. And in some sense, the first world finds itself in this question of epidemic, contagious, transmissible disease, in a similar position vis-a-vis the third world, that obviously broaches all kinds of wonderful potentials if they ever are grasped.
Thank you. David?
I'll just respond to your question about whether something will happen in the next 12 months or so. We preparing as if it will, and it's already out there. So the question is, how fast will it move? What will be the impact? And I think also the fact that so many corporations are global. You know, it's not about their home headquarters and where a large mass of their employees are. Companies are thinking about it from the perspective that they are a global company, and that they're just as affected if they have a an operation or more than one operation in China or India or Vietnam or Pakistan or France or Poland or Argentina or Brazil as they are wherever the headquarters are. So from a concept of a corporate perspective, they have to prepare because they are global companies and there's going to be an impact. Whether it's large or small, that's where the uncertainty is. But it's going to happen to them, whether it's in a small or a large way.
A couple of questions. Is it going to happen in the next 12 months? I certainly don't know. I just hope, all I can say is I hope it doesn't happen, but to be honest, I don't think anyone knows. I think there was an interesting question once more about political reward, and I'd like to add to what John Oxford said. The reward is staying in power, which is what politics is all about. And I think the governments that are great, that the greatest risk are the more authoritarian ones. Because a failure like this is enough actually to set in motion huge political changes. And I think this is one of the reasons why China is taking avian influenza as seriously as it did. Because it saw the political impact that the mishandling of a disease can have. And there's both, once more, a domestic political impact as well as the international one. The international one we all know about, but also there is a domestic impact. I don't want to go into this, but clearly, yes, there is a reward. And the reward really is whether you're going to stay in power or not. And I think one of the side effects of a pandemic, if and when it does happen, really is the kind of political changes, both globally and within nations that it might set in motion.
John?
Your question, am I worried? I think that was the question. I don't think I am, and nor are my children. My children, they're all adults, but they all think that I've got a stock of antiviral drugs sitting in my cupboard, which I haven't because I've given it all away to Tom, Dick and Harry who comes in. Maybe that's why they're not worried. But I don't think I am now. I was much more concerned 18 months ago, 2 years ago, when none of us were moving about this, and now everyone is moving and taking action. I find that totally reassuring. Even DEFRA. Sorry about that. shouldn't have said that. With this question of the time, politicians are very keen on roadmaps, and they never get anywhere with these roadmaps, at least not the roadmaps that they've been talking about and go on about endlessly. But I'm keen myself on navigation. And I've got a navigation point, and I'm a bit more used to the Rich and I get invited more often to the Rich and Judy show than I do to the London School of Economics. And on one of them a couple of weeks ago, just as we were finishing off our little chat, which was quite good actually, I think it was Richard who said, "Well, when do you expect an outbreak then?" Caught unawares, I said, "Well, probably in the next 18 months." And in a sense, I realised afterwards that was my navigation point. 18 months is not, you know, you've got to aim for somewhere. It's no good just drifting around. And it says, well, 18 months is not a bad navigation point. And I think the WHO really, in their real speak, that's what they mean for politicians. They mean, don't think 10 years, don't think 8 years, don't think 2 months. Take something pretty sensible and putting it all together, 18 months is not a bad navigation point. And if that is correct, and it's only guessing, we'll all be much more prepared then. It'll be like the Thames Barrier. Really would. And finally, your point about, I mean, you know, there has not been a flood in the last 20 years. You could say it was a waste of money, but it's an insurance policy. Insurance policies are never wastes of money, I don't think.
Thank you. And how many of you are worried about the pandemic risk now? Has it increased or decreased?
Decreased.
Decreased slightly. I'd like to thank a number of people for this evening. I'd like to thank actually my two colleagues, Will Jennings and Javier Lazorn. They were the brains behind this event. It was their idea, and they actually went ahead and executed this evening's event by seeking out the panelists, drafting letters, and actually even helping to secure the funding. So they should both be thanked very much indeed. Also, our admin team, Phil, Stephanie and Sonia, put a lot of work into this evening. It's always hidden, of course, the admin work on these events, but it's always quite enormous. And the ESRC, of course, who helped fund this evening and have made it part of Social Science Week. There are brochures out here for you to look at about other events that are worth looking at. But finally, I'd like to ask you to join me in thanking the panel. We appreciate very much that they all gave their time up. Some of them travelled very long distances indeed to come here and talk to us. And it changed some of your minds, perhaps in a positive way, so maybe it was some good. And I think we all find your comments very, very interesting, and we like the disagreements always at the LSE, so the disagreements were particularly well received here. So thank you very much indeed, and thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.